Today on Against the Grain.
Most people around the world saw a potential war against Iraq as a form of imperial predation, all too familiar to them from the history of American war-making and interventions, you know, whose ultimate prize was oil, or at the very least, geopolitical control over the Middle East.
As the United States seizes control of Venezuela, what lessons can be drawn from the movements against the U.S. occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq? Historian Jeremy Varin reflects on how the anti-war movement grew into the millions in the face of jingoism and media complicity with the U.S. state. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. They were the largest coordinated protests in history. Up to 30 million people rallied in cities around the world against an impending invasion of Iraq. In Our Grief is Not a Cry for War, the Movement to Stop the War on Terror, historian and participant Jeremy Varin looks back at the anti-war movement to assess its victories and failures at a crucial moment in U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration. Varin teaches at the New School. Jeremy, I'd like to begin by asking you why it is that the movement to stop the war on terror is so little remembered today, except, of course, for those who are involved in it.
I mean, I think two big reasons. First, the anti-war movement was woefully underreported on in its own day, right? Ignored mostly for years by the mainstream media. It had only an episodic presence in the headlines or in the larger public consciousness. So, you know, the stifling or marginalization of the movement, properly speaking, began in its own day. And it was one of the movement's great frustrations that it did not get the kind of public attention that it deserved, because its ability to influence, you know, policymakers or voters or change hearts and minds depended on a kind of visibility. Beyond that, I think in general, the United States and Americans don't really know what to do with the war on terror. It was in many ways a difficult and dispiriting history, starting with the horror of 9/11 itself, and then two endless wars that the United States essentially lost, immense costs in blood and treasure, an episode of being lied to by government, breeding a sense of cynicism and mistrust. So not only is the anti-war movement little remembered today, I think there's a woeful lack of reckoning with the totality of the war on terror, the damage to America's global reputation, increases in executive power, the flouting of domestic and international law, divisiveness within the American public and the American electorate. So partly what I'm trying to do with this book is to bring into the light or rescue from the memory hole the anti-war movement as part of a larger effort to encourage a comprehensive moral, legal, political, and cultural reckoning with the war on terror itself.
Well, I wonder if you could take us back to those awful early days, which started with the attacks on September 11th, 2001.
Yeah, so I was in New York City at the time, and it was, you know, absolutely horrible, as the world, you know, saw. It was arguably the most covered event in, you know, human history, in a sense designed to be a kind of global spectacle, and, you know, that it was. And, you know, inside New York City itself, it was absolutely wrenching. All of these, you know, posters of missing loved ones and doctors and nurses, you know, at the ready to treat the wounded. There almost were no wounded. And anger, fear, and confusion, you know, reigned on the streets, along with a sense of fellowship and camaraderie amidst the tragedy that many New Yorkers, you know, remember very, you know, fondly. And then right away, George Bush made it clear that the United States was going to go to war against somebody, And for sure, a lot of people in New York City wanted the crime of 9/11 to be avenged and were cheering on, you know, national leaders as they, you know, gave the outlines of the American military response. But a lot of New Yorkers questioned the wisdom and ethics of a highly militarized response to 9/11. And the basic notion was 9/11 was so awful because of the cruel wasting of civilian lives. And if we make war on people thousands of miles away and kill civilians, we won't have answered the crime of 9/11. We will have, in a sense, repeated the crime of 9/11. So New York City was, you know, the epicenter of the 9/11 attacks, and also, as it turns out, an epicenter of sorts of the American, you know, anti-war movement. Again, based on the premise that we should not visit on foreign peoples and foreign civilians, especially the same horror and the same grief that New Yorkers endured. And then the title of the book, Our Grief Is Not a Cry for War, was coined by a New York City artist, a fellow named Dred Scott. And then within a week or so of the 9/11 attacks, one of the first public protests against the looming war in Afghanistan took place, where people silently held large printed signs at Union Square and other sort of landmarks throughout New York City in a sort of silent protest of the looming war. And the basic idea is that the grief and sense of hardship and sorrow of New Yorkers should not be exploited by national political figures as a reason to wage limitless war.
What was the importance of dissent and opposition to impending war by what came to be known as 9/11 families, that is, people who had lost loved ones in the attacks on September 11th, including in those really horrible weeks following the attacks when it felt like to speak out in any way was absolutely verboten and you were going to be slapped down?
You know, many New Yorkers lost loved ones on 9/11. And some small but significant percentage of family members of the deceased adamantly did not want a strongly military response to the murder of, you know, their loved ones. And Bush and other leaders really advertised the war on terror as being done in the name of and on behalf of the 9/11 dead and their family members. And Ground Zero became what I call the sort of spiritual epicenter of the war on terror, right? And then America's response was to radiate out from the scene of this terrible crime. And again, some 9/11 family members said, this is not what my loved one would have wanted, or gave the warning that the times were inhuman enough and America should not add to the inhumanity of our times with a reckless, open-ended military intervention. And then, as you know, suggested, these folks as dissidents had a credibility in the eyes of the media that many other Americans, you know, would appear to lack. They clearly had, you know, suffered the loss of their loved ones. What they, you know, said mattered, and they couldn't easily be accused of, you know, being anti-patriotic. After all, they were really the arch victims of the 9/11 crime. So when they say there has to be an alternative to war, it had a kind of salience or standing in the media in those early days when the country was very pro-war. And as you said, any dissident voice was viewed with, you know, profound suspicion.
Although your book focuses on organizing against the war on terror, obviously the context of what the U.S. government was doing is crucial here. So I wonder if you could remind listeners how the U.S. government responded to those attacks, within what kind of time frame, and also the role of the media in supporting that agenda without any criticism.
So, you know, the attacks happened on September 11th. By September 26th, there were already CIA assets on the ground trying to gin up local resistance to the Taliban. The bombardment of Afghanistan begins on October 7th, you know, less than a month. So a lot happened very, very quickly. And in retrospect, it feels like the war on terror was, you know, inexorable and unstoppable. And then I like to, you know, remind the reader that a brief window existed when, in principle at least, other options were available. And dissident voices, people on the left, people in the, you know, international law community were pleading, why don't we treat this as a terrible crime? And then frame the war on terror as a global police action designed to catch the perpetrators to the extent that that's possible, and then try and convict them within some competent global tribunal, and in so doing, demonstrate to the world America's genuine concern with security and fidelity to the rule of law, much like was done in Nuremberg in the wake of the end of, you know, World War II. But those voices never got much of a foothold. And then, you know, literally within days of the attacks, the United States was planning a full-bore assault on Afghanistan, whose goal was not simply to decimate al-Qaeda and potentially capture bin Laden, but to destroy the entire Taliban government that the U.S. saw as complicit in the 9/11 crimes. And then a key plank of the Bush doctrine is that if you aid and abet terrorists, we will treat you as guilty as the perpetrators of terror. And by that logic, the Taliban were utterly illegitimate and an appropriate target of America's military intervention.
Before we talk about how the Bush administration turned its sights from Afghanistan to Iraq, which really was the center of the war on terror and also organizing against it, I wonder if you could talk about how you see the emergent anti-war movement that you were describing, how people were raising questions about the logic of going to war with countries based on the actions of this organization, al-Qaeda, how that emergent movement relates to earlier anti-war movements. Are there lineages that we can trace that kind of fed into the growth of the anti-war movement against invading Afghanistan, invading Iraq, the war on terror? And I particularly wanted to ask you about its relationship to the global justice movement, which of course had seen its high watermark in 1999 in Seattle against the World Trade Organization, and which foundered really just with the attacks of September 11th.
So I like to joke that, you know, the first people to oppose the war on terror tended to be the communists and the pacifists, right? So pacifists, and there's is a tradition of organized pacifism in the United States. They tend to have a moral critique of war, but understand that profit-seeking is often a major motive for war. And communists tend to have a sophisticated geopolitical analysis of American empire while also having some understanding of the human costs of war. So these are sort of two groups who are ideologically predisposed to oppose whatever American military intervention emerges after 9/11. A third group I would throw in there would be anti-war veterans, like members of Veterans for Peace or people who are still part of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So these are, you know, the grunts who have served in America's wars and understand that war making is often folly dictated by civilian leaders with, you know, no sense of the sacrifice that they're asking young men and women to bear, and that there's a kind of inherent corruption to American war making, which so often serves the interests of elites and not the interests of common Americans. So these three groups, you know, such as they were, spoke up. But in the beginning, they were a very, very, very small minority. And the war in Afghanistan was intensely popular, 88, 90, 92% of the public in favor, depending on the polling you look at. And a very tiny minority was against the war. And the folks who were against the war made a variety of arguments. One is that a lot of civilians are going to die, right? And again, you're going to repeat the crime of 9/11, not avenge it, that war is bloody business, and civilians typically bear the suffering. And a lot had a sense early on that the war might start in Afghanistan, but not end there, that 9/11 would be used essentially as a pretext for a larger neo-imperial project that the United States would embark on in ways removed from the legitimate security interests following 9/11 to incapacitate a terrorist enemy that was operational in a handful of geographies. And then that big prediction or warning absolutely came to pass. Now, to your other question, probably the most dynamic movement on the left at the time was the so-called global justice movement, dedicated to addressing gross inequalities of wealth and power on a global scale. And the premise of that movement is that for years, the Cold War was framed by America's leaders as the fundamental global divide between prosperity versus a kind of, you know, coerced economic stagnation, freedom versus, you know, communist tyranny. And then with the Cold War finally out of the way, we could look with clearer vision at really the enduring, you know, sort of contradiction or tension civilizationally. And that's the gap between rich and poor. And for a few glorious years, there was intense activism against American institutions of soft power, USAID, World Bank, IMF, and then the global misdeeds of US-based multinational corporations to try to sort of even the world's, you know, balance sheets and then promote economic development, advances in, you know, the provision of food, housing, and so forth. And then this movement had made, you know, fantastic headway in just a few years' time. Then 9/11 happened, and that movement almost instantly evaporated. Bush said that the great challenge or question the world had to ask is whether they were with or against the United States, for or against terror. Right? The world had to choose. And then that frame and the urgent need to oppose U.S. war making, in the short term at least, overwhelmed the concerns and the organization and the esprit of that earlier movement, which never really transitioned into the anti-war movement in a way that was capable of preserving its dynamism, creativity, and energy.
Historian Jeremy Varon is my guest. We're discussing Our Grief is Not a Cry for War, the movement to stop the war on terror. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So how did this movement against the war on terror evolve as the Bush administration went from invading Afghanistan, which you said at the time was very popular, to setting its sights on Iraq?
So, you know, it's been revealed in retrospect that Bush made the decision, let's, quote, do Afghanistan first, right? Conquer the Taliban, bring some modicum of stability, and then move on to the more ambitious project of engaging Iraq. And there were people in and around Bush sort of chomping at the bit to sort of finish the unfinished business of the 1991 Gulf War, depose Saddam, as part of an effort to assert a kind of Pax Americana over a remade Middle East that would be good for the oil profits of Western oil companies, good for, you know, arms manufacturers, I assume, and then good for America geostrategically and geopolitically. So not longer after the Afghanistan war was ostensibly won, all of the military and political planning turned towards a threatened invasion of Iraq. And you had months and months and months of public allegations that Iraq possessed and had the capacity and the will to use so-called weapons of mass destruction against American interests and ultimately the American people. And then the ultimate nightmare that they spun was that Iraq had the ability to create a nuclear bomb of whatever sophistication. It had connections with Al-Qaeda, and somehow it would put a weapon of mass destruction into the hands of devious terrorists who conceivably could literally detonate a nuclear device in, you know, middle America. So this is the kind of apocalyptic nightmare fear that was at the center of a larger propaganda campaign to convince Americans that there was a military security necessity in incapacitating Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction program and deposing Saddam Hussein to install a regime that would be, you know, friendly to the United States. And it was, you know, a highly orchestrated campaign. And for months and months, as you may recall, there was this sort of public debate, should the United States invade, you know, or not? And a lot of Americans were skeptical of a prospective war against Iraq. You know, 35% to 40%, you know, per the polling, were against such a war, either because they didn't believe Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, or they thought inspectors should go back into Iraq to find out if he did, or they thought even if he does have weapons of mass destruction, there must be a diplomatic way of resolving the crisis short of, you know, a military intervention. And in a way, the anti-war movement was you know, most spirited and most robust before the war even started.
Right. And of course, the demonstrations that took place in February of 2003, just before the U.S. invaded Iraq, have been called the largest coordinated protests in the world, in the United States, of course, but around the globe. What was involved to get so many people out onto the streets at that time?
So the idea for a global day of protest against the threatened war with Iraq originated out of a meeting of the European Social Forum in Italy. And they put out a call initially for European-wide protests, and then it spread to sort of all corners of the globe. And there was this six-week period of frenzied organizing, you know, literally all over the world, to try to turn out as many people as humanly possible. And then on or around February 15th, indeed between 15 and 30 million people, you know, took to the streets under the slogan, "The world says no to war." And the simple message to Bush and secondarily to Blair was, don't invade Iraq. And, you know, it's important to note that the United States had immense sympathy following 9/11, and most global publics were broadly on the side of American intervention in Afghanistan because they saw it as America exercising a legitimate right of self-defense. By contrast, most people around the world saw a potential war against Iraq as a form of imperial predation, all too familiar to them from the history of American war-making and interventions, you know, whose ultimate prize was oil, or at the very least, geopolitical control over the Middle East. And Europeans turned out in enormous numbers, you know, 2 to 3 million in Spain, 2 to 3 million in Italy, close to 2 million in Hyde Park in London. So this was a kind of global referendum against the next phase of the war on terror. And the hope, of course, is that it would force Bush and the people around him to stand down because they would think the invasion would be too great a risk with this volume and energy of, you know, global dissent. And, you know, as we know, the demonstrations, as powerful as they were, did not achieve their goal. And some weeks later, the United States indeed invaded Iraq.
Well, I don't want to get too far ahead in the story, because obviously this was not the end of the anti-war movement, but I wanted to ask you how you think we should judge the success of those protests in February of 2003 before the U.S. invaded Iraq. So many people at the time felt like it was a total failure because they weren't able to stop it. In hindsight, how do you judge it?
That is a superb question. You know, the record is a mixed one. The anti-war movement understood that the time to stop a war is before it starts. So to say that the movement failed in its core objective because the war started despite its protest isn't a way of running down the movement in my mind. It's a way of crediting the movement with the insight that war fundamentally is about death and destruction and untold, you know, human suffering. So the only way to have forestalled the crime and the tragedy of the Iraq War was to, you know, prevent it from taking place in the first place. And a lot of activists were crushed and crestfallen and hurt and outraged that Bush et al., you know, went ahead with the planned invasion. And yet the demonstrations did have some positive and enduring effects. I mean, one is that they isolated the Bush administration on the world stage. Bush, despite, you know, assembling a coalition of the willing, like a handful of countries nominally involved in military operations in Iraq, it was pretty much the United States and Great Britain going it alone, without the assent of the United Nations, without, you know, sort of resource help from, you know, the global community. So America's capacity to wage the war was in the first instance diminished by the moral and political isolation of the United States on the world stage. And then those demonstrations, I think, typified the very fact of that marginalization. It also, you know, established transnational linkages that at various points after that were activated in additional days of global protest. So a kind of infrastructure for globalized dissent was established. And then, you know, most importantly, it demonstrated that Bush could have his war, but it lacked the legitimacy of consensus. And he was doing this over the better wisdom and judgment and moral sense of a huge portion of the American people. And then the idea for the anti-war movement was to grow that sizable minority that was suspicious of the war all along and turn it through the patient winning of hearts and minds into a durable majority, and then have that majority opinion eventually reflected in the political class who by various mechanisms could, you know, force an end to the conflict. And then over the long term, that's pretty much what happened. You know, too late to save hundreds of thousands of lives and the sapping of blood and treasure. But within the long arc of the resistance, those protests were an important early marker that, you know, indicated you can have this war, but over the heads and over the spirited objections of a sizable portion of your own country.
Well, putting that longer view aside for a moment, at the time, did it take the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement that it couldn't stop the U.S. from invading Iraq? And how did the movement change as the invasion then became an occupation?
Right up until the start of the war, there was intense anti-war activity. So there's the February 15th protest that we've, you know, spoken of at length already. There was also this thing called the Lysistrata Project, where a few New York City artists had this idea that this anti-war Greek play from antiquity would be performed all over the world. And then indeed it was performed in over, you know, 1,000 locations on a given day. So this was the largest ever theatrical performance in the history of the world. You also had a mass distributed reading of anti-war poetry in the largest public poetry event in the history of the world. So there were a lot of sort of record-breaking moments in this fevered run-up to the start of the war. It wasn't just February 15th. And sure, people were, you know, devastated when the war started. And then in early days, it appeared that despite all odds, George Bush had more or less pulled off what he intended: depose Saddam, a minimum of U.S. casualties, not that much death and destruction on, you know, the Iraqi side. And initially, the war appeared to be going, you know, swimmingly well. And then this was, of course, you know, deceptive, as the world sort of figured out. So the anti-war movement had to, you know, pivot from protesting a threatened invasion to protesting an occupation. And then for a little while, at least, thought that the war was, you know, kind of done and dusted, and was thinking about how do we prevent the next war, which might be against, you know, Iran. But then things started coming undone with the occupation fairly early on. And then the goal of the movement, very much like it was, you know, during the Vietnam War, was U.S. troops out, let's, you know, end this debacle before it gets qualitatively worse. And then, you know, the main position of the anti-war movement from the, you know, the spring of 2003 on was basically bring the troops home and again end this, you know, military misadventure.
I'm speaking with historian Jeremy Varin about Our Grief Is Not a Cry for War, the Movement to Stop the War on Terror. This is Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So the key groups organizing the anti-war demonstrations and activism were complicated in their own ways. United for Peace and Justice, which became the leading coalition, was made up of a lot of groups, and some of them actually had, you know, not that many members. They were nonprofits of various kinds. And then there was the Answer Coalition, which was headed by an undemocratic sectarian group. As you look at the way the movement organized itself through these different coalitions, what do you glean about the strengths and weaknesses of the movement? And did the characteristics of the different coalitions show up in limitations to the organizing?
So it's important to acknowledge that there can be, you know, meaningful differences in worldviews among, you know, activists. Like, we don't all agree on sort of all points. And at the same time, sectarianism and intramural conflict is generally destructive of the overall impact of a movement. And then I think that was very much, you know, the case with the movement that I described. There was a huge schism between these rival organizations. One of them, as you said, was hard left with its roots in, you know, the sectarian Marxist left. And then the other one was what I call the kind of institutional left, you know, nonprofit managers, the heads of, you know, venerable peace and justice organizations, etc. And, you know, they agreed in the main goal of trying to end the war, but they sort of disagreed about everything else, you know, organizing tactics, rhetoric, messaging, you know, which slogans to use. And they spent and ultimately wasted an enormous amount of time fighting each other as opposed to struggling against the common enemy, which was the Bush administration.
You mentioned earlier how the media really shut out the anti-war movement. And one of the things that you describe as a characteristic, kind of a hallmark of the movement in many ways, was a kind of battle over truth, or the politics of truth, that there was this sense, especially given the misinformation that was intentionally fostered by the U.S. government to try and sell the public on the Iraq invasion. And of course, the mainstream media's willingness to go along and look the other way when really rather absurd claims were being made, that made so many activists think that the kind of fight over the real story, the fight over truth, was crucial. And this was an important moment for alternative media trying to provide a different perspective about the whole premise of the war, including claims of weapons of mass destruction and so on. I wonder if you could talk about that struggle on the terrain of truth, because sort of embedded within it was an assumption that if the American people just heard the truth, the real truth, then that would lead to a big shift in consciousness. People will be politicized in a different way, which, you know, is something that has characterized, I think, social movements going back at least to the Vietnam War. How important was truth, and how much was that assumption about truth, the unveiling of the truth, being so crucial to actually get people to change their minds?
So it was, you know, a rough era for the truth. And like, let's recall that the Iraq War was predicated on a deliberately and carefully calculated set of lies, that Saddam had an active WMD program, that Iraq somehow colluded with al-Qaeda in the, you know, 9/11 attacks, and this sense that Iraq represented a grave and impermissible threat to the security of the United States. So there was something deliberately fraudulent about the very premise. The mainstream media, as you indicated, was deeply complicit in the perpetration of the fraud by not asking tough questions in the face of wild administration allegations, you know, not doing its due diligence and doing far too little to encourage in the public a healthy skepticism towards, you know, the claims of, you know, the U.S. government. Deceit was woven into the war, you know, from the start. And then to me, and my research, you know, sort of revealed this, the second great deception had to do with the nature of the Iraqi insurgency and the extent to which it was driven by resentment and outrage at the conduct of the U.S. military after Iraq was invaded. Sure, there were some al-Qaeda types, there were some religious zealots, there were some, you know, local potentates, you know, interested in sort of enriching themselves. But the core of the resistance was nationalist, as Iraqis felt that they were subject to the brutality of a reckless and clumsy and uninvited occupier. And the Iraqi people turned against the invasion as a response to the brutal interrogation of, you know, alleged terrorist suspects and these horrible nighttime raids where, you know, Marines would ransack family homes and frighten women and children and steal jewelry and money and passports and march off, you know, young men, fathers and grandfathers into some sprawling detention system where they would be held indefinitely without charge and subject to physical and psychological, you know, torture. So the United States turned itself into an enemy in Iraq by virtue of its conduct. And then this was, I think, systematically underreported by the media. And I think a lot of Americans just had a confused sense as to why the Iraqis were rejecting the gift of freedom. You know, we toppled a brutal dictator after all. You know, shouldn't you be grateful? And then by the time sectarian conflict really set in 2005, 2006, the whole thing became a kind of inscrutable mess without any clear media narrative as to why the Americans, qua imperial aggressors, were being rejected and you know, fought against by what had become a vast guerrilla insurgency. You know, so a standard play of the anti-war movement was to try to reveal to Americans, to the extent possible, the truth as to what was really happening in Iraq. And then some of the most heroic work was by anti-war citizen journalists who physically went to Iraq and tried to report the real truth of what was going on, and then broadcast what they found to the best of their ability back to the domestic audience. And then a primary venue for this kind of reportage was Democracy Now! This program that I'm now on was started just a few weeks before the run-up to the war. KPFA, the Pacific Radio Empire, was trying to tell the truth on the ground. A lot of the most creative and intense work that the movement did was not just to report, you know, garish facts and figures, but to try to dramatize the human story behind the statistics. Arguably the most, you know, poignant of these was Camp Casey emerging in 2005, where you have the mother of a dead U.S. service member wanting to confront the president to ask him in his Texas ranch, for what noble cause did my son die? And here you have this very powerful symbolic standoff between a bereaved mother and the man responsible for her son's death. And then I would argue that Camp Casey, which was in the summer of 2005, did break through in a new and exciting and sustained way and did have some demonstrable impact in the eventual shift in public opinion by which the majority of Americans rejected the Iraq War.
George W. Bush was reelected in 2004 to the, you know, horror of activists. And as you've described, the U.S. public started seeing the Iraq War differently, especially since it became apparent that it would not be a quick operation, as Bush had promised. How much of that do you think was shaped just by events in Iraq, that is? And how much of it was influenced by the anti-war movement, including from dissenting members of the military who, you know, may or may not have considered themselves as officially part of that movement?
Right. And first, let me pivot a little bit back to your prior excellent question. You know, there was a point at which Americans were confronted over and over again with, like, the real truth, but chose not to believe it. And for years after the invasion, huge percentages of Americans thought that America had found WMD in Iraq, or that there indeed did exist proof that somehow Saddam Hussein was partially behind 9/11. And then this is the anticipation of the sort of post-truth condition that we're in now under Trump, where the empirical refutation of a lie or a myth seems powerless to shake people's, you know, belief in that myth. So that was an immense frustration of the movement, that again and again and again, the public could be confronted with what would seem to be empirical refutation of the cause of war, the administration narrative about it, but it didn't necessarily budge people, including in their, you know, behavior as voters. And remarkably, Bush wins re-election in 2004. This is post Abu Ghraib. This is when it's clear that there are no Iraqi WMD, when it's clear that the mission was not accomplished. And yet, despite the accumulating failures of the Iraq War, which really was his signature policy in his first term. And then, you know, you've asked a very difficult question. Did the American public turn against the war because it was going badly, or because they were persuaded by what the anti-war movement was telling them about it? And then I would say it's a combination of both, and it's impossible with any precision to say, was it the war itself or the movement? And I think it was, you know, a kind of synergy between the two. And then as I like to think about it, eventually public opinion caught up with the anti-war movement. Right, it became clearer and clearer if you, you know, watch the news, even in a cursory way, that the mission was not being accomplished, that Iraq was not being liberated. And beyond a certain point, Iraq became an unmanageable maelstrom of chaos and death. So it had become sort of so patently a quagmire. And people observing this quagmire had access to the arguments that the anti-war movement had been making all along, one of which is that this is destined to become a quagmire. And there was the anti-war movement sort of waiting in the wings. So when public opinion started to turn, people gravitated more and more, you know, towards the anti-war position, if not also the anti-war movement. And then, as you said, the movement gained some very credible messengers in the form of veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, freshly returned from battle, describing, often in vivid detail, the extent of the barbarism of American military operations, the extent to which the Iraqis resented the U.S. military and didn't see it as a liberating army, the sort of inscrutable factionalism inside Iraq, and then this sense from the soldiers that they were being sacrificed, asked to kill or be killed for a muddled mission and no objective ultimately worthy of their sacrifice. And I wouldn't say the anti-war veterans, you know, alone like moved any needle, but they were well represented in anti-war discourse, and no doubt some Americans listened to them in a way that they wouldn't a garden variety anti-war protester.
To when do you date the end of the movement against the war on terror, since it was, of course, not just about Iraq or Afghanistan? Endless wars, drone attacks in other countries, renditions of people to black sites, the holding of prisoners in Guantanamo, etc. To when would you date the end of this movement against endless wars?
Two answers to that question. Like, the big fall off came with the election of Barack Obama in 2008 and his inauguration in 2009. And then people have done, you know, empirical analysis of the frequency and size of anti-war demonstrations. And from 2009 on, there is a massive, massive reduction in the frequency and numbers of people who are hitting the streets. And the basic notion is, our man is in the White House now, he's going to preside over the end of the war, so there's no real reason to protest any longer because the official policy is in broad alignment with the main thing that the anti-war movement wanted. That said, in my mind, the movement against the war on terror, you know, hasn't ended because so many of its toxic features persist. I've been a longstanding member of an organization called Witness Against Torture, whose primary, though not only objective, has been to shutter the U.S. war on terror torture prison in Guantanamo, Cuba. And the prison remains open, now periodically housing migrants expelled from the United States. So there are living vestiges or legacies of the war on terror, and some small but determined number of Americans continuing to struggle against them.
The U.S. eventually pulled out of Iraq and then Afghanistan in 2021. Are there lessons that you would draw from the movement against the war on terror for today, especially in light of the U.S.'s attack on Venezuela?
So let me first say that I think the abduction of Maduro is illegal, risky, and wrong. It potentially ushers in a new era of impunity, not of American power per se, but even worse, of an American leader to kidnap, kill, bomb, and bully other nations without constraint. The Trump administration is openly defying international law, domestic law, Congress, global norms, the views of its allies, and even potentially the will of the American people, only one-third of whom seem to support Maduro's capture. Now, for an anti-war movement, I think things are complex. Its prospects depend massively on the conduct of the Trump regime and the intensity and scope of its aggression. And this is really always the case with anti-war movements. Their fate is tied to the war itself. When a nation wins, they don't fare so well. Their power increases when people have reason to question the cost in blood and treasure. Trump, I think, knows this, complicating anti-war politics. His promise was no stupid wars, no reckless sacrifice of American lives, but at the same time, he's a warmonger at heart who revels in violence. So he wants it both ways, to be a global predator, but with minimal risk to Americans. Hence, we have drone strikes on the high seas, missiles, special ops to kidnap a president, and a naval siege that could literally starve Venezuela into submission by wrecking its economy if it can't sell oil. So it's coercion, but it's not yet boots on the ground. And just today, Trump said, we're not at war. So if Trump does opt for a land invasion of Venezuela or even maybe next Cuba, it may have opened the gates of hell, truly creating another Iraq. So in my view, you know, either prospect is terrifying. The first involves mass death and destruction and will surely be met with mass protest. The latter, if it's remotely achievable, may prove tolerable to many Americans and the political class as a kind of imperialism light seen as benefiting America, or at the very least, nothing that critics can really stop.
Given that it does look like we are living in an era of heightened bellicosity, do you think that there are things that you would counsel activists today to do or not do based on the experience of the movement against the war on terror?
I mean, absolutely. I think at this point, anti-war forces need to completely flood the zone with every conceivable argument against what Trump is doing. Fears of another Iraq, threats to the rule of law, the brazen authoritarianism of it all, the fact that Venezuela is not high on America's list of priorities. And the main idea is to sow worry and doubt among a population that is already skeptical of the unfolding conduct. And then if anything goes wrong, if Trump, you know, sort of mismanages his own intentions, you can then grow and amplify the resistance. And hopefully you'll have a critical mass of people so skeptical or so disapproving that it becomes hard to execute the policy with any consistency. I mean, wars can have, and they can also lose legitimacy. And then it's hard, there's no formula to say when they lose legitimacy. But the anti-war movement, you know, as it emerges, needs to sow skepticism, worry, and doubt with words of caution. And I think stressing what a blow to, you know, American democracy, you know, this is, which is a continuation of, you know, Trump's authoritarianism. He's acting like a bully at home without constraint. He's acting like a bully in the international arena without constraint. The more he gets away with domestically, the more emboldened he is internationally, and vice versa. And I think ultimately, this might not be, you know, the answer people want to hear, but we need to politically neutralize the MAGA movement and drive this whole crew of people and the ideology they represent, you know, from office. And with Trump, it's hard to win on any particular policy. At best, you can, you know, sort of limit the damage. And at some level, this whole authoritarian cabal, you know, must go.
Jeremy Varin, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Thank you so much.
Jeremy Varin is the author of Our Grief is Not a Cry for War, The Movement to Stop the War on Terror. He's professor of history at the New School, a longstanding activist with Witness Against Torture. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.